Chapter 54.
"Explain it to me again," Remy whispered. "Why couldn't this wait till morning?"
"It is morning," Sam replied, turning the wheel slightly to keep the bow on course. Though their destination showed no lights, its bell tower was nicely silhouetted against the night sky. From above, Povelia looked like a fan, measuring 500 yards from its flared tip to its base, and 300 yards at its waist where a narrow, walled canal bisected the island from west to east, save for a sandbar in the center.
"Don't get technical on me, Fargo. As far as I'm concerned, 2 a.m. is the middle of the night. It isn't morning until the sun comes up."
After drinks with Maria, they'd managed to find an open boat rental office. The owner had only one craft left, a 12-foot open dory with an outboard motor. Though not luxurious by any means, it would suffice, Sam decided. Povelia was only 3 miles from Venice, inside the sheltering arms of the lagoon, and there was little wind.
"Don't tell me you bought into Maria's stories," Sam said.
"No, but they weren't exactly cheery."
"That's the truth.
In addition to having served as a dumping ground for plague victims, throughout its 1,000-year history, Povelia had been home to monasteries, colonies, a fort and ammunition depot for Napoleon, and most recently in the 1920s, a psychiatric hospital. In frightening detail, Maria had explained that the doctor in charge, after hearing the patients complain about seeing the ghosts of plague victims, began to conduct crude lobotomies and gruesome experiments on the inmates, his own brand of medical exorcism. Legend had it that the doctor eventually began seeing the same ghosts his patients had reported and went insane. One night he climbed up the bell tower and jumped to his death. The remaining patients returned the doctor's body to the bell tower and sealed the exits, entombing him forever. Shortly thereafter, the hospital and the island were abandoned, but to this day Venetians reported hearing Povelia's bell ringing or seeing ghostly lights moving in the windows of the hospital wing. Povelia was, Maria told them, the most haunted place in Italy.
"No, I don't buy the part about the ghosts," Remy said. "But what went on in that hospital is well documented. Besides, the island's closed to tourism. We're breaking and entering."
"That's never stopped us before."
"Just trying to be the voice of reason."
"Well, I have to admit, it's very creepy, but we're so close to solving this riddle, I want to get it done."
"Me too.
But promise me something.
One gong from that bell tower and we're gone."
"If that happens, you'll have to race me to the boat."
A few minutes later, the mouth of the canal came into view. A few 100 yards down the shoreline, they could see the dark outline of the hospital wing and bell tower rising over the treetops.
"See any phantom lights?" Sam asked.
"Keep joking, funny man."
He maneuvered the dory through the chop created by the lapping waves, and they slipped into the canal. Sheltered from the seaward side, the canal saw little circulation. The surface was brackish and dotted with lily pads, and in some places the water was only a few feet deep. To their right, a brick wall draped in vines slipped past. To their left, trees and scrub brush. Above, they heard the rasp of wings and looked up to see bats wheeling and diving after insects.
"Just great," Remy muttered. "It had to be bats."
Sam chuckled. Remy had no fear of spiders or snakes or bugs, but she loathed bats, calling them rats with wings and tiny human hands. 10 minutes later, they reached the sandbar. Sam revved the engine, driving the bow onto the soil. Then Remy got out and dragged the dory a few feet higher. Sam joined her and staked down the bow line. They clicked on their flashlights.
"Which way?" she asked.
He pointed to their left, north end of the island. They walked across the sandbar, then up the opposite bank to a dense hedge of scrub. They found a thin spot, pushed their way through, and emerged in a football-sized field surrounded by low trees. Remy whispered,
"Is this?"
"It might be."
None of the maps of Pavalia had agreed upon the exact locations of the plague pits. Either way, it's odd that nothing's growing here. They continued across the field, stepping gingerly and shining their flashlights over the dirt. If this was the site of a plague pit, they were treading on the remains of tens of thousands of people. When they reached the opposite tree line, Sam led them east for 100 feet before turning north again. The trees thinned out and they emerged into a small clearing filled with knee-high grass. Through the trees on the other side of the clearing, they could see moonlight glinting off water. In the distance rang a gong.
"Buoy in the lagoon," Sam whispered.
"Thank God." My heart skipped a couple beats.
"Here's something." They walked forward and stopped before a block of stone peeking above the grass. Must have been part of a foundation.
"Over there, Sam."
Remy was shining her flashlight at what looked like a fence post on the right side of the clearing. They walked over. Affixed to the post was a plexiglass enclosed placard. 9th century site of the followers of Pietro Tredonico, Doge of Venice, 836-864. Remains disinterred and relocated in 1805. Pavalia Historical Society.
"If Tredonico was here, he's gone now," Remy said.
"Relocated in 1805," Sam read again. "That was about the time Napoleon was crowned King of Italy, right?" Remy caught on. "And about the time he had Pavalia converted to a munitions depot. If Laurent was with him, this is probably where they got their inspiration for the riddle."
"And they would have known where Tredonico's remains were sent."
"Remy, there was never a bottle here. The whole riddle was just a stepping stone to send Napoleon Jr. somewhere else."
"But where?"
The next morning, at 8:02, Sam and Remy's water taxi stopped on a small side street 2 blocks east of Santa Maria Maddalena Church. They paid the driver, got out, and stepped up to a red door bordered by black wrought iron railing. A tiny bronze plaque on the wall beside the door read, "Pavalia Historical Society." Sam pressed the buzzer. They heard footsteps clicking on wood, and then the door opened, revealing a plump woman in a pink and yellow floral dress.
"Si?"
"Buongiorno," Remy said. "Parla inglese?"
"Yes, I speak English very well. Can I help you?"
"Are you the curator?"
"Pardon?"
"Of the Pavalia Historical Society," Sam said, smiling and pointing to the plaque. The woman leaned out the door, squinted at the plaque, then frowned.
"That's old," she said. "The society hasn't met for 5 or 6 years.
"Why?"
"All that ghost business. All people wanted to know about was the hospital and the plague pits. The rest of its history was forgotten. I was the secretary, Rosella Bernardi."
"Perhaps you might be able to help us," Remy said. She introduced herself and Sam. "We have a few questions about Pavalia."
Signora Bernardi shrugged, motioned them inside, then led them down the hall into a kitchen decorated in black and white checkered tile.
"Sit. I have coffee made," she said, pointing to the kitchen table.
She filled 3 mugs from a silver percolator, then sat down.
"What do you want to know?"
"We're interested in Pietro Tredonico," Sam said. "Do you know if he was buried on Pavalia?"
Signora Bernardi got up, walked across the kitchen, and opened a cabinet above the sink. She pulled down what looked like a brown leather photo album and returned to the table. She opened the album and flipped to a page near the middle. Under a sheet of acetate was a yellowed sheet of paper bearing dozens of lines of handwritten notes.
"Is that an original reference?" Remy asked.
"Si. This is the 1805 government census data of Pavalia. When Napoleon ordered the island annexed, the government hurried to erase its checkered past."
"Which included the settlements established by Tredonico and his followers?"
"Yes, those two. According to this,
Pietro Tradonico and his wife, Magella, were buried side by side on Povelia. When they were disinterred, their bones were stored together in the same coffin, then temporarily placed in the basement of the Basilica della Salute.
Sam and Remy exchanged a glance. Here was the solution to the riddle's last line. Together they rest.
You said temporarily, Sam said.
Does it say where the remains went after that?
Signora Bernardi traced her index finger down the sheet, then flipped to the next page. Halfway down the next sheet, she stopped.
They were taken home, she announced.
Home? Where exactly?
Tradonico was Istrian by birth.
Yes, we know.
Members of the Tradonico clan came and took the bodies to their village of Ortage. That's in Croatia, you know.
Remy smiled.
Yes.
What they did with Tradonico and his wife once they reached Peroi, we don't know.
Does that answer your questions?
It does, Sam said, then stood up. Both he and Remy shook Signora Bernardi's hand, then walked down the hall and out the front door, where she stopped them.
If you find them, please let me know. I can update my records. I doubt anyone else will ask, but at least I'll have it written down.
Signora Bernardi gave them a wave, then shut the door.
Croatia, here we come, Remy said.
Sam, who had been tapping on his iPhone, now held up the screen. There's a flight leaving in 2 hours. We'll be there for lunch. Sam's estimate was generous. As it turned out, the quickest route was an Alitalia flight from Venice to Rome, then across the Adriatic to Trieste, where they rented a car and drove across the border and south to Opportage, some 30 miles away. They arrived in late afternoon. Situated atop a 1,000-foot hill in the Myrna Valley, Opportage had a distinctly Mediterranean feel, with terracotta pantile roofs and sun-drenched slopes covered in vineyards and olive groves. Opportage's history as an ancient medieval fort showed itself in the town's labyrinth of cobblestone streets, portcullis gates, and tightly packed row-style buildings. After stopping 3 times for directions, which came in either halting English or Italian, they found the town hall a few blocks east of the main road, behind the church of St. Gerai. They parked their car beneath an olive tree and got out and walked. With only 1,100 inhabitants in Opportage, Sam and Remy were hoping the Tradonico family name would be renowned. They weren't disappointed. At their mention of the former doge, the clerk nodded and drew them a map on a piece of scratch paper.
Museo Tradonico, he said in passable Italian.
The map took them north, up a hill, past a cow pasture, then down a zigzagging alley to a garage-sized building painted in peeling cornflower blue. The hand-painted sign above the door had 6 words, most of them in consonant-heavy Croat, but one word was recognizable. Tradonico. They pushed through the door. A bell chimed overhead. To their left was an L-shaped wooden counter. Directly ahead, a 20-by-20-foot room in white stucco and dark vertical beams. A half-dozen glass display cases were situated around the room. Along the walls, shelves displayed tiny sculptures, framed icons, and knick-knacks. A rattan ceiling fan wobbled and creaked. An elderly man in wire-rimmed glasses and a tattered argyle sweater vest rose from his chair behind the counter.
Dobar dan.
Sam opened the Croat phrase book he'd picked up at the Trieste airport and opened it to a dog-eared page.
Zdravo. Imeje Sam.
He pointed to Remy and she smiled.
Remy.
The man pointed a thumb at his chest.
Andrei.
Govrote le angliski? Sam asked.
Andrei waggled his hand from side to side.
Little English.
American?
Yes, Sam nodded. From California.
We're looking for Pietro Tradonico, said Remy. The doge?
Yes.
Doge dead.
Yes, we know. Is he here?
No. Dead. Long time dead.
Sam tried a different tack. We came from Venice, from Povelia Island. Tredonico was brought here from Povelia.
Andre's eyes lit up and he nodded.
Yes, 1805. Pietro and wife, Magella. This way.
Andre came out from behind the counter and led them to a glass case in the center of the room. He pointed to a framed wood-carved icon painted in flaking gold leaf. It showed a narrow-faced man with a long nose.
Pietro, Andre said.
There were other items in the case, mostly pieces of jewelry and figurines. Sam and Remy walked around the case, inspecting each shelf. They looked at one another, shook their heads.
Are you a Tredonico? Remy asked, gesturing to him.
Andre Tredonico?
Da.
Yes.
Sam and Remy had discussed this next part on the plane, but hadn't decided how to handle it. How exactly did you tell someone you wanted to gawk at their ancestors' remains?
We would like to see... Perhaps we could...
See body?
Yes, if it's not an inconvenience.
Sure. No problem.
They followed him through a door behind the counter and down a short hallway to another door. He produced an old-fashioned skeleton key from his vest pocket and opened the door. A wave of cool, musty air billowed out. Somewhere they heard water dripping. Andre reached through the door and jerked down a piece of twine. A single light bulb glowed to life, revealing a set of stone steps descending into darkness.
Catacombs, Andre said, then started down the steps.
Sam and Remy followed. The light faded behind them. After they'd descended 30 feet, the steps took a sharp right and stopped. They heard Andre's shoes scuffing on stone, then a click. To their right, a string of 6 bulbs popped on, illuminating a long, narrow stone passageway. Cut into each wall were rectangular niches, stacked one atop the other to the 20-foot ceiling and spread down the length of the passage. In the glare of the widely spaced bulbs, most of the niches were cast in shadows.
I count 50, Sam whispered to Remy.
48, Andre replied. 2 empty.
Then not all of the Tredonico family is here? Remy asked.
All?
He chuckled.
No, too many. The rest in graveyard. Come, come.
Andre led them down the corridor, occasionally pointing at niches.
Drazen, Jadranke, Girger, Nada, my great-great-great-grandmother.
As Sam and Remy passed each niche, they caught glimpses of the skeletal remains, a jawbone, a hand, a femur, bits of rotted cloth or leather. Andre stopped at the end of the passageway and knelt at the bottom niche in the right-hand wall.
Pietro,
he said matter-of-factly, then pointed at the niche above.
Magella.
He reached into his pants pocket, withdrew a tiny flashlight, and handed it to Sam.
Please.
Sam clicked it on and shined it into Pietro's niche. A skull stared back. He shined it down the length of the skeleton. He repeated the process with Magella's niche. Just another skeleton.
Nothing but bones, Remy whispered.
Then again, what were we expecting? That one of them would be holding the bottle? True, but it was worth a try. He turned to Andre. When they were brought from Povelia, was there anything else with them?
Pardon?
Were there any belongings, Remy said. Personal possessions?
Yes, yes. You saw upstairs.
Nothing else? A bottle with French writing on it?
French? No. No bottle.
Sam and Remy looked at one another.
Damn, he whispered.
No bottle,
Andre repeated. A box.
What?
French writing, yes?
Yes.
There was box inside coffin. Small, shaped like a loaf of bread.
Yes, that's it, Remy replied.
Andre stepped around them and walked back down the passageway. Sam and Remy hurried after him. Andre stopped at the first niche beside the steps. He knelt down, leaned inside, rummaged about, then scooted back out with a wooden crate covered in Cyrillic stencils. It was a World War II ammunition crate. Andre opened the lid.
This,
lying atop folds of rotted canvas and half buried under spools of twine, rusted hand tools, and dented cans of paint, was a familiar-looking box.
Good God,
Sam murmured.
May I?
Remy asked Andre. He shrugged. Remy knelt down and carefully lifted the box out. She turned it over in her hands, inspecting each side in turn, before finally looking up at Sam and nodding. Sam asked,
Is there something in it?
Yes.